Hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into yet another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nestler. And that's just a taste of Malarumba, something called El Sombrero Blanco. Malarumba takes the stage tonight at the Temporary at 8 o'clock. On the edge between desire and fear, between the known and unknown, is a place deep inside us where all spirit is transformed, pushed beyond its limit by our deliberate commitment to usher in something new and original. In this soulful place, we are catalyzed to learn, expand, and engender newfound understanding to inspire others on their journeys. That is what greets you when you visit fivepointfilm.org. Their flagship festival comes to Carbondale next week, and I spoke earlier today with Meredith McKee about this year's program. Meredith McKee, the program director for 5 Point Film, joins the program now. Welcome, Meredith.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Are you all excited?
We are so excited. We've been planning away for the last 6 months pretty heavily for 5 Point, which is one of Carbondale's biggest events. And we have special guests coming from Australia, from the UK, from all over the country and the world to be here. And Carbondale community really puts on this event and makes it happen. And we are thrilled to be bringing all these people here from all over the world.
Is this the 11th?
This is the 11th year.
How about that?
Last year, we celebrated our 10th year anniversary. And when Julie Kennedy started the festival, she basically struggled to even get films because film was so different 11 years ago. So we are honored to be carrying the torch 11 years later, and we can't wait to show all these films to our audience.
From the very beginning, you guys have never been just an adventure porn film festival. You've always had a soulful element. Talk a little bit about that.
Exactly. I think in the action sports community, it is easy to showcase the over-the-top adventures or showcase, you know, the pinnacle moment of someone jumping off a cliff or going off of a huge waterfall on a kayak. But to us, basically what 5 Point is about, it's about the human story and the human element, and the people that we feature in our films also happen to be some of the world's best athletes. But the story is really to make it a human story and make these films relatable to everyone, no matter whether an adventure for them is getting out for a walk with their girlfriends in the neighborhood, or if it is, you know, what we see in these films, which is going to Greenland and kayaking for 6 months to make a film. Mm-hmm. And one of our themes is adventure belongs to all. And I think that the 5 Points and the films that we showcase very much encompass that adventure belongs to all.
Well, I've noticed from your website already, a couple of the nights are sold out, Friday night and Saturday night. What's that, program 2 and 3?
Program 2 and 3, yes.
But there are still tickets for the Thursday night, program 1, and the Sunday afternoon, program 4. So let's focus a little bit on some of the films that you're having on those 2 days.
Definitely. And yeah, Friday and Saturday sold out really quickly. And we like to remind people that every program is a signature program. So while those Friday and Saturday shows are still sold out, we will have, if you want to show up at 6 p.m. on the night of, you can actually wait in line and try and get a ticket. But if you want to secure your spot, Thursday and Sunday are still available. Thursday night is the kickoff to 5 Point. To me, that program is a perfect representation of everything that a 5 Point night represents. We have some adventure films. We have a climbing film featuring a 90-year-old climber. We also have a film that is a world premiere called The Return to Mount Kennedy. And it is about Bobby Whitaker, who is the son of the former REI CEO. He was also a huge, he played a huge role in the Kennedy administration, working on some of their campaigns. And so that is a world premiere. And we are super excited to have Bobby coming and the producer and director, Eric Becker, coming to showcase their film. On Thursday, we also have a local person that most people will know very well.
Jacques.
Exactly. If you don't know him, Thursday would be a great opportunity to get to know him. Michelle Smith is a local filmmaker, and she spent the last year with him making this film. And he's famous for mountain biking, having a great attitude about life, skiing, and he's also famous for giving lots of kisses in his very European and French way. And the film is actually called The Frenchie.
And known for wearing shorts in January.
Exactly. And that film to me is, it's one of our favorite films because it's really, really funny. Uh-huh. Sometimes these films can be a little serious. Uh-huh. And to me, this just lightens the mood. And Jacques teaches us how to take on life no matter what comes our way, which is very much a five-point film.
You also have one film on that program featuring or by Alex Honnold.
Yes, that film, I'm glad that you brought that film up. It's called The Life Coach, and it is a North Face film. And basically, Renan Ozturk, who got his start kind of at Five Point with Camp Four Collective, which is a huge production company in the outdoor world, him and Alex go on an adventure together and do some winter climbing, which is not, Alex is not usually used to that. He's used to doing El Cap and being in the desert. So they kind of learn from each other along this trip. And Alex actually turns the camera on Renan and tells his story. He's been a filmmaker for many years. So it's this really sweet way to capture a friendship. And it also shows kind of Renan basically stopped his climbing career to be a filmmaker. And so this kind of gives an opportunity for Alex to turn the camera on him and tell his story a little bit.
Oh, interesting. And they're doing that because they're waiting out a storm in a tent? Is that what's going on?
I think that's part of the reason, yeah, they're waiting out a storm. But Renan has been such a soulful filmmaker for so many years that I think that part of the reason that why they did that story was to help share his story because he's given back so much to the climbing community.
Okay. That sounds like a really interesting program. Really interesting. Well, let's talk about the Sunday program. Tickets are still available for that. It runs from 2 to 5:30. There are 10 films on that program.
Yeah, so the Sunday program is the Changemakers program. And to us, a changemaker is someone who, you know, teaches us about becoming a better person through their story and helping to change communities through their stories. So that Sunday program is actually on Earth Day. And our theme this year is Our Stories, Our Lands for the festival. So we have a couple environmental films that will be in that section of films. And then we also have some running films. And we also have The Last Honey Hunter, which is a pretty well-known film in the outdoor world over the last year. It's beautifully shot in Nepal. And it's about one of the last gentlemen who actually they go and they climb to these great heights on ropes that look very unsafe compared to what we think of as climbing, and they climb up into these bluffs to get honey that actually is sold to heal people in Nepal and that region of the world. And to us, that character is a perfect person as a change maker. He's supporting his family, supporting his community, and helping to heal people by doing these really dangerous things to get the honey that helps heal people. And it's one of the most beautiful films, best cinematography that we've had in any of the films in a long time.
Hmm. And there's kind of an interesting subtext to that film, I think, that I've read because I've heard about this film. It's something about a dream that gets passed down generation to generation. And if somebody is visited by that dream, that means they have to go up onto the cliffs and get the honey. Is that?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So he basically, as a young man, he had this dream. And it basically, if you have a dream, this becomes your life mission. And no matter what you want to do, I mean, in America, it's like you can do anything you want to do. And in their culture, if you have a dream that tells you what you're supposed to do, you have to carry it out for your family. And so he feels this great burden to take on the role of being the last honey hunter. But because the dream is so crucial to his society, he continues to do this job for his community.
Even because no one else has been visited by that dream.
Exactly.
Interesting. Wow, that's really trippy. That's very trippy. Let's see. And then one about Easter Island.
It's called Ammo, An Island Story, and it's made by Max Lowe, who is a renowned filmmaker. And he actually has 3 films in this program. And he travels to Easter Island to document the local community there and basically captures that their language and their dialect and their community is getting compromised by tourists and the modern day world, and they're working incredibly hard to protect that. And so the filmmaker Max actually works under the Cousteau Fellowship. They have a fellowship, they choose a filmmaker every year, and he went to document the culture and kind of help send us the message that it's really important to preserve this culture. And what I love about this film and a lot of the other 5-point films is that it takes us to a place that we're never going to be able to go and experience a culture we probably won't be able to experience in our lifetime. So we learn a lot from Max, and all of the filmmakers who went are all either in college or budding filmmakers. And that's a huge theme of 5.2. You know, we have the established filmmakers who have huge budgets for films, but we also have a lot of young and upcoming filmmakers who are incredibly talented. And this is one of those films that we're really excited to showcase.
And then one of the very intriguing films has a premiere on Saturday, The Bikes of Wrath. Tell me about The Bikes of Wrath.
The Bikes of Wrath is such an amazing story. It's hard for me to describe in words what this film has done for me. So I really hope that people can come and attend. So 5 Australian young men in their early 20s to mid 30s decide to come to America and bike the Grapes of Wrath route that the Jode family took.
Highway 66.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Wow.
So they start in Oklahoma with $420 in the kitty. That's what they call it, which is their bank. It's an Australian term. So they start with a proportional amount of what the Jode family had when they came across the country. So they don't have very much money. They're not in the best shape, but they basically plan on going across the country based on busking. They bring their instruments. And it is a really interesting snapshot to me of where we are in America today. They basically, you know, interact with a ton of people in the local communities, and a lot of them are rural communities. And these people who don't necessarily have a lot to give meet the bikers, understand what they're doing, and want to help them and help feed them or give them $100 just to get them to their goal. And so it kind of is a film that talks about wealth disparity in America, subtly talks about immigration, but it's also an adventure film of 5 young men going across the country trying to beat the clock to reach their bike goal.
Leave it to Australians to show us ourselves.
Exactly. And I think, to me, if Americans had done the same trip, I don't know if they would have received the same openness. And so I think, in a way, that this film had to be made by someone who wasn't from our country, because they're so open and people were so open to share their stories with them because they were kind of a visitor to our country. And we actually have a lot of the cast coming over from Australia to be here for the world premiere. And we also have a couple who is featured in the film. They're from Oklahoma, and they helped take care of the boys when they kind of got hurt or needed help along the way. They'd check in with them. And they're actually driving all the way here from Oklahoma to be a part of the premiere. And so there's going to be a Q&A after the film with all of these people that we fall in love with during the film.
Wow, and there's still tickets to that one.
Tickets are still available.
Great, that sounds like a winner right there.
To me, this is one of the programs I'm the most excited about. I think it's going to be a really special experience, and this film gives us hope during a time where maybe a lot of people are feeling very separated and divided from each other. And so I think that this film and its message really transcend what we're even trying to do at Five Point with adventure films. To me, it's a much bigger topic that I hope the world premiere is here. And then I hope that this film becomes incredibly successful and gets to travel across the country. But we're honored to have the first look.
Well, Meredith, before I let you go, many of us are familiar with some of the ancillary events around Five Point, the Van Life Rally, the podcast, the live podcast. One that I wanted to touch base with you on that looked intriguing to me was Sarah Yule doing a festival-long, 3 or 4 day live art installation. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sarah Yule has been a part of the Five Point family for a long time, and she's an incredibly talented artist. So she's doing a live art exhibit where she's painting on individual wooden boards, and she'll be painting all sorts of different landscapes that reflect the Carbondale landscape, that reflect public lands, and people can actually buy those throughout the weekend. They can come up and say, hey, Sarah, I really like this board. I want to purchase this board. Or they can come up and there's a blank canvas board and they just say, I trust you, I'm going to purchase this. And all of the proceeds go to the Hayden Kennedy Fund. And the Hayden Kennedy Fund was set up after Hayden unfortunately passed away this year. But all of the proceeds go to public lands and ensuring that public lands are a part of our country. And so we're honored to have Sarah doing this installation as kind of a live interactive experience for our audience. But also, she's going to be raising a ton of money for the Hayden Fund, which is huge.
That is huge. And that's beautiful. Once again, fivepointfilm.org has all the information you need for this year's festival. You can get tickets there or you can visit aspenshowtix.com. Yasamar Dance Troupe closes out its residency at Dance Initiative tonight with a studio performance of a work in progress that is already sold out. I spoke with Associate Artistic Director of Yasamar Dance Theater, Zoe Rabinowitz, yesterday.
Happy to welcome Zoe Rabinowitz from Yasamar Dance Theater Company.
I was going to ask how that's pronounced. Now I know.
Yes.
Well, I kept saying Samar, and Zoe kept saying Samar, and now Zoe say it.
Samar.
So that's pretty close. Cool.
Oh, yeah, it's like Samar.
Samar.
What does that mean? Is that Arabic?
It is. Samar means, it's Samar's name, which means a sleepless night of entertainment. Ooh. Yeah.
So you're thoughtful.
Mm-hmm. It's not just a name.
It's not
ethos.
Just a dance. It's an ethos. Tell me more. What do you do?
Well, we make multimedia dance theater works that incorporate dance, theater, set design, video, text, and costume design to tell these multi-layered stories and narratives of often underrepresented communities, the narratives of people that you might not normally hear about or see on stage. We try to uplift and amplify those voices, whether those are Arabs or Americans or immigrants or refugees. Those are the nights of entertainment that we try to offer, and we do these often evening length pieces that deal with the socio-political issues.
What does evening length mean? I was wondering about that.
Evening length could be anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour and 10. We try to get to like a 60 to 75 minutes is the sweet spot, I think, without boring people too much.
Is it a matter of boredom or is it physical limitations? I mean, like you can only dance for so long.
Oh, no. We can train. We could go forever, but I think it's about an audience's attention span and also the tightness of a story. You know, a well-edited and well-rehearsed piece gets tighter and tighter. And, you know, often we'll start with a work that's an hour and 15 minutes, and through its iterations, it'll become shorter and get, you know, if we can shave off 5 or 10 minutes, we feel like we're doing a good job because that way we're tightening and kind of editing out the irrelevant material.
Okay. Your mission statement says that you, as you partly described, transnational aims to inspire transnational dialogue, social and social discourse through artist development, education, and live performance. Mm-hmm. So it's the three-pronged approach to that.
Yeah.
I watched the video on your website of the summer camp, and that was very inspiring because you talk there's a some writing on the screen that describes where all of these kids are coming from. Mm-hmm. And I see some Hebrew names and I see some Arabic names. Mm-hmm. Is this the first time that many of these kids from both sides of the Green Line are playing together?
Yeah, it is. Wow. It's true. We work primarily with Palestinian communities within Israel and with communities in the West Bank. And because of the occupation wall and the separation wall, those communities often have no contact. So it's part of the mission of the company to unite those communities through artistic projects. And, you know, not just those communities. We travel all over the world and try to, you know, tell the universal stories of humanity and inspire that sort of human connection that inspires transnational dialogue and social discourse that shows the connectivity more than the difference. But definitely the summer camp is a really unique program and one that's the first of its kind for Palestinian youth living both in Israel and in the West Bank.
Well, is the Yasamar Dance Theater also the first of its kind?
Yeah. I would say so. Yeah. I mean, we're definitely embarking on a new model. And I think it's the way of the future in that, you know, artists work across borders already. You know, they're people from South Korea who live in Berlin, and there are people from the U.S. who work in Tunisia, and, you know, the world is getting smaller and we're all globalizing. But to have a dance company that is duly based between Palestine and New York and that works with artists from both continents and whose mission is to really bring those diverse communities together. And we're not just Arabs and Americans. We have Japanese dancers. We have African-American. We have Latino. You know, we have a whole blend of people that we've worked with and really working across borders in the way that we do, I think, is the first of its kind. And also, especially within the landscape of Israel and Palestine, definitely the first of our kind there.
Well, in reading up on this, I discovered somewhere in one of the interviews that it was either you or Samar did, somewhere they said there's a lot of dance in Palestine, but there's not any dance training.
Mm.
Is that a fair statement still?
It's changing, but it's true. I mean, there's a pretty significant contemporary dance scene in the West Bank in particular. There's an international dance festival that's been going on for about 15 years there. So that's really cultivated an audience and appreciation for contemporary dance. One of the downfalls of the festival culture is that many people come in for the festival season and they bring workshops from Europe, from South America, from West Africa, North Africa, all over the world, and they work with artists in Palestine. But when the festival season is over, those artists leave, and often the Palestinian dancers who remain are left with these huge vacant times of without training, without opportunity, or they have to leave in order to pursue that training in a more continuous environment. So what we're hoping to offer are, you know, the training and the opportunities to fill those gaps when it's not festival season, when the Europeans or the Americans aren't always there to offer special workshops, that we can have a continuous scene that will build the dance community in a way that's sustainable.
Mm-hmm. And part of that, obviously, is developing dancers.
Mm-hmm.
Have you got a ready core of dancers in Palestine?
Yeah, I mean, we have four core company members in Palestine, and then we have a rotating mix of artists that we work with on a project-to-project basis. And I would say that group has expanded in number to, you know, 10 to 12 artists that we can call upon for various projects that we've worked with through the summer training program, through other camps and intensives. And it's really interesting because these artists come from such varied backgrounds. We have artists who are traditional Debke, the folkloric dance dancers. We have hip hop artists. We have circus performers. We have street performers, classical ballet, modern trained, and we have actors and singers. So finding how to cultivate all of those skills and synthesize them into the performance has been really interesting, and also has pushed the work forward in really vibrant ways, in that we're not all, you know, coming from the same background artistically or culturally, and drawing on the unique skills of all of these varied artists that are there already.
When I visit your website, ysdt.org, the first thing I see is a video, the trailer of a work that you completed last year called Against a Hard Surface. I wonder if you describe for our listeners that piece.
Yeah. Against a Hard Surface asks what happens to a group of people separated from the rest of the world by a wall. And it's taking sort of a macrocosmic view of this question, in that it's looking at humanity, or these humans, as creatures, as like a biological experiment, like what actually happens to the physical as well as emotional and mental state of any organism that's confined by these boundaries. What is the evolutionary tactic of a community that is continually bound by these restrictive borders? So the piece features a wall on stage, and the dancers, the performers, are continuously engaging with that boundary and trying to surmount it somehow, whether it's to climb over, to bash through, to dig under, to seduce it, to cajole it, you know, to somehow find new ways to overcome and find out what's on the other side. So it's an evening length piece that is very repetitive and heavy in a way, because you see these people continuously trying and failing in some ways to overcome this boundary.
And they're doing it. It's interesting to me, as I watched it, a riveting video. I watched it four or five times.
Oh, thank you.
And one thing I noticed, for instance, is that they all have the same movements, but they're not all coordinated.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and it's interesting that you describe it in biological terms, Darwinian terms, because one of the metaphors that occurred to me as I watched it was an amoeba trying to get up and over it. And, you know, and some of them are kind of, forgive the pun, knocking their head against the wall, and others kind of get halfway up and then they fall back, and then they're all kind of milling about. And
yeah,
really interesting piece.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm really happy that you see that also in terms of the physicality and the broader questions that raises in terms of the effect on an organism, on a body, or on a group of bodies, and how that affects those people or those creatures.
And I read a little background on that piece, and it was really fascinating to me, for instance, to realize that, well, first of all, to maintain an international dance troupe in the face of lots of logistical issues, whether it's visas or violence, sporadic violence, whatever it is, and it takes a certain commitment to really push through those things. And that's so... Americans are cloistered, and you know, compared to the idea that those people have to fight just to dance.
Yeah.
That's just mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, it's true. We created that piece over a six-week residency at the Palestinian Museum in Bir Zeit in the West Bank. During that time, there was the largest Palestinian prisoner strike within Israeli prisons that had ever occurred. So entire cities were shut down in solidarity with prisoners who were on hunger strikes against the conditions in their jail. And, you know, there were water shortages, electricity cutting out, you know, a whole host of issues at one performance. One of our dancers was denied their visa to even go to Jerusalem, which is the next town over. So we've had dancers risk their lives and their freedom to get to a performance. And that is really humbling as a director of the company to know that there are artists that are willing to put their lives on the line. And it really, I think, raises the stakes for all of us and the commitment for everyone there that it is life or death, that we are so committed to each other and to the work that, yeah, we're willing to put ourselves on the line. And, you know, for me as an American witnessing that, as you said, it's like so far outside of our realm of reality. It's just hard to imagine. But I feel really lucky to be able to work with these artists.
Well, you mentioned that that was developed in residency. And the reason that you're in Carbondale with your troupe is because you're having a residency here with Dance Initiative. So let's bring in Peter Gilbert to talk about that residency, which culminates Friday evening at the launch pad. Peter, how did you come across Yasamar, and tell me more about what's happening?
Well, first, Luke, I want to say that I'm going to keep my answer as short as possible so that you'll get Zoe to keep talking, because we only have the company here for another day, and I'm already trying to figure out how we get them back. But how do we meet? Zoe and another artistic partner danced and created a film of that dance that was shown at the Dance Film Festival in New York. I think it was in February of, 2 years ago?
2016.
Yeah. And I was able to attend that evening. And it's part of my job for Dance Initiative when I recognize dance that I like and the artist happens to be in attendance. I go up to the artist and, you know, introduce myself and say, would you ever think about coming to Carbondale and participate in a residency? And we started talking and we communicated after back and forth. But it wasn't until October of 2016 when I was back in New York and Deborah Colley, who is the associate director of Dance Initiative, she came with me because we were interviewing, I think there were seven different choreographers that we were meeting and potentially offering a residency. And Deborah got to meet Zoe, and I wasn't able to attend that meeting, but Deborah came back and said, I love her, and but she's got this other project that she works in that is really something special. And so, Deborah told me what it was. And so we changed from just having Zoe with her previous partner to come to the company, the Samar company to come out. And it took a year to put it all together to get schedules and it worked out, and they're here, and they traveled for 30 some odd hours to get here in some cases. Zoe only came from New York only. it's been pretty phenomenal. There are eight people here for the week.
That's one of your largest groups.
It is the largest group, and it's been phenomenally successful from Dance Initiative's point of view, because we truly have been blessed with a company that they're not only great movers and artists, they have something to say. This is the first time we've really had a group where it's even more important than just the art of dance, which is obviously what we're interested in promoting and helping the creation of dance. But this is really important.
You know, I wonder if that's why I was so attracted to the videos that I watched on your website. You know, a lot of modern dance seems very cerebral, kind of like bebop jazz. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have that driving, funky beat. Not that your dancing does. It's not even in that realm. But but there's that distinction that I was making, and I think that's why I was so drawn to it, because what I saw in those videos is very kinetic, very insistent, and evidently that's because it comes out of the context it comes out of. So that's interesting to me. But so you're here Friday night. You're performing a studio performance of a work in progress. Can you give us a sense of the work in progress? Is it anything like Against a Hard Surface? Does it extend the themes? What's going on with that piece?
Yeah, we will be sharing the work in progress for a new work entitled The Keeper. And we started the creation process for that work last Friday when we arrived in Carbondale. So it will be 8 days into a new process. So we're really excited to share the very beginning stages of our creative process. We will also be sharing a couple excerpts from Against a Hard Surface just to sort of share a little more context for our work. The Keeper deals with land and humanity's relationship to the earth as a source of political conflict, as a source of survival, comfort, a sense of place and belonging, and what it means to belong to a place. In some ways, those themes do definitely extend from Against a Hard Surface, which, you know, in a way dealt with territory. But we are bringing this a little further in that we're working with an actor, Khalife Nitor, who is a very renowned Palestinian actor. And he will be developing a script with Amir Nizar Zoghabi, who is the theater director who's co-directing this piece. So in a way, we're approaching it from a more theatrical lens, but we'll have six dancers and one actor on stage. And the finished product will also involve soil on the stage. We didn't bother Peter to bring a pile of dirt into the launch pad for this week, but we did take a beautiful hike yesterday and sort of to immerse ourselves in the earth and also to be able to take the experience of being in this place where the land is so beautiful and so vibrant, to take part of that experience with us as we move into this work.
Huh. Well, you know, Yasamar has roots in the Promised Land, and so many of modern problems come from land and claims to it. So you guys are right on point, aren't you? I mean, you've got a piece about a wall, and that's incredibly current.
Right.
Days.
I know. Maybe we're like prophesying.
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 Well, you know, that's what artists are supposed to do.
Right.
Isn't it?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me also that this work is coming up now with the idea of a connection to land at the same time that so much of the world is becoming disconnected from the land and living apart from our environment. So I think it'll also raise questions about what it means to be integrated into an ecosystem, what it is to, you know, with climate change and the definite changes that we're seeing in our landscape, and how we are connected and implicated in that, and recognizing that we don't live, you know, removed from our environment.
Mm. Do you find being out west in Colorado clarifies that issue for you? Because I can't say that a lot of people who live here share that viewpoint.
Mm.
You see what I'm saying? It might be, you know, if you're in New York City or
right.
if you're in any city,
right.
you're not going to have a connection with the land. But here it seems easier to
right.
connect to the land.
Totally.
Did you get that? Is
yeah,
that something you're feeling?
Definitely, definitely. And I grew up in Vermont, which is another place that's very connected.
Yeah.
to the land, and I've had the experience, and I'm curious what will happen when we go back to New York on Saturday, that sometimes when I'm in these really beautiful natural environments for extended periods, when I go back to New York, I have this sense of anxiety, like the earth is like suffocating, like there's cement everywhere, and there are, you know, buildings and subways, and one of my family members said, you know, you should think about the city also as a natural outcropping, like a coral reef, you know. So how can we imagine that we're still living inside the environment. We're still inhabiting the earth, and stay connected even when you live in a metropolitan area, because, you know, around the world, the trend is that rural communities are moving and integrating more and more into urban centers, you know, whether that's happening in China or in Bangladesh or in the United States, it seems less. And in some way, the land that we have here is one of our like greatest assets and gifts, that there's so much space. And that's something that I know the dancers coming from Palestine have really been struck by, that, you know, the amount of space here, the amount of natural beauty, and the ease with which one can sort of interact and engage with that.
Huh. Interesting. You mentioned this is the very beginnings of Keepers, and I read that you're taking another residency in New York and then a 6-week residency in Paris.
Yeah. Yep.
The same piece.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We will be developing this work next week in New York at the Baryshnikov Art Center. And in Paris, we'll be at the Le Théâtre National de Chaillot, the Chaillot National Theater, from May 22nd to June 23rd. And through that residency, we'll be finalizing the creative process. So hopefully by the end of June, we'll have sort of a draft, maybe not the most final draft, but we'll have a draft of the performance by the end of June.
Oh, interesting. Peter, I read somewhere that you can't charge for the performance on Friday night because of visa restrictions for some of the dance troupe. What do you anticipate? There will be walk-up space for walk-up people coming in?
We already have a waiting list because can't fit that many seats in, because it's at the launch pad, and so you know how that space is pretty confined.
Yeah.
So giving enough room for the dancers to work, and so we don't have poor visibility for anybody that has a seat. We can only fit in, you know, less than 50 seats. But there will be some room to stand, and I'm sure we'll get people to come in. And Samara said that it probably won't be more than an hour, with some talk and some dance, and so shouldn't be too taxing for this very fit community to stand and watch for a while.
Okay. Well, Zoe Rabinowitz, thank you for joining us here at KD&K.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're so welcome. And Peter Gilbert, same with you. Thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you as always, Luke, for helping us promote the projects.
This one didn't need any promotion, did it?
Yeah, I agree with that. But it's still hard to get the word out in this valley. So.
Yeah. Well, I just think, you know, even though there's nothing to promote per se, it's really interesting work that you're doing, Zoe, you and your partner, and all the best to you, because it's important. And I can see that from a remove.
Mm.
You know, I can see that from thousands of miles away. I saw the faces of those kids in that summer camp video, and I saw the kinetic dance and all of it. It seems really, really important these days.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Luke.
Well, as I said, tonight's performance is sold out. You can check out their website, ysdt.org, and lots of photos and videos there that capture well what Yasamar Dance Theater does. Stay with me. More to come on today's Express Yourself. That's a little bit of the Blue Kings. The Blue Kings are a rock steady ska band out of Denver, and they will play here on Carbondale
on Sunday night at Kenny and Kay's 35th birthday party. Unfortunately, the originally scheduled band, the Dendrites, had to cancel their weekend gigs due to a family emergency. So come on out and celebrate Kenny and Kay's 35th birthday with the Blue Kings starting at 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. Well, let's close off today's Express Yourself with some audio from Katie and Kay's earliest days. If we don't remember the past, we might just have to repeat it. To commemorate our landmark birthday on Sunday, please enjoy these clips from Katie and Kay's audio archive. And let's start off with the first co-manager of Katie and Kay, Pat Noel, who was manager along with Wick Moses, explaining how Katie and Kay got its call letters.
Sharing the manager's hot seat with Moses was Pat Noel.
Well, let's see now. Of course, I was a station manager with no station. I was actually co-manager with Wick Moses. There was the idea for a station, and there was a space. We helped paint this very room we're sitting in, by the way, and soundproof it. But there wasn't any. There weren't any toys. And one of my jobs. Well, I had three jobs actually. We had one of the consoles set up in the basement of the Centennial Building across the street, and three times a week I would schedule people to come in and pretend they were doing a radio show. So we'd push and pull buttons and turn knobs, and that was one of my jobs. The other job was to throw parties, and we threw a bunch of theme parties to raise money for the station. And then my third job was to, we hadn't any call letters. We were operating under a thing called CCAR, Carbondale Community Access Radio. And we wanted to call it KCAR, but those letters were taken. And so I was given the responsibility of checking certain call letters with the FCC, and they had a rule that you could only call up three times a day. You could only give them three numbers every time you called up, or three sets of call letters. So I was working in Aspen at the time at Aspen Magazine, so I used their phone to call Washington three times a day, and thanks a lot for the paying the phone bill, guys, by the way. And I call up and say KBLLY, KKRB, or whatever the sets, and then this sort of disembodied voice at the end would go, no. So I'd hang up, and I'd wait 3 hours, and I'd call up again, and we had, like, lists of letters. And so finally we stumbled on the combination KDNK, and this went on for about 2 weeks. And so I finished one set with KDNK, and the voice said, yes. So that's how we got our call letters. And the DNK stands for Dinkle, of course, the Dinkle Building, which we are in, the historic name for it.
I remember program on KDNK tonight. I have Ruth Fender as a guest. Ruth has grown up in this valley. Her parents and grandparents are well known in this area, in Missouri Heights, Cattle Creek, Crystal Springs, well, all over this part of our country.
This is the This I Remember show. And this is really the first time that I've had the pleasure of sitting in and trying to help with this show. I find it a fascinating thing that we're doing here.
I'm in slow motion. Sorry. Hi, this is Sherilyn.
Some people call me Candy. How's your day going so far? I'll be rocking these Rockies every Wednesday from 10 till noon. My show is comfortably sandwiched between crusty Twinkies and New Dimensions. Tune me in at 10 bells. That's every hump day on KDNK.
You betcha.
Hey, there will be a premenstrual syndrome seminar on Saturday, May 9th at the Jesus of the Christ. Excuse me. There will be a premenstrual syndrome seminar on Saturday, May 9th at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Say, kids, what time is it?
It's time for the Sister Sisters.
Do you think that my pants are too tight?
Yes.
Do you think that I creep in the night and sleep in a phone booth?
Yes.
Do you think that I'm creepy?
Yes.
Do you think that I dream through the night of holding you near me?
Yes.
Susie, like I know Susie. Oh, 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 what a gal. There's none so classy as this fair lassie. Oh, 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 holy Moses, what a chassis. We went riding, she didn't walk. And coming back from Yonkers, I'm the one that had to walk. If you knew Susie, like I know Susie.
Well, I guess it's that time of evening that we're supposed to talk about Susie Johnston.
Mm. Well, the first thing that, of course, everybody knows by now is she's got in some competition with the talent show. She's in at least three acts that I know of. We probably could call Mike Spear and ask him if she's in all of them.
Mm-hmm. Because she probably is trying to be, because she just wants to clinch it so she can win. She wins everything in town, for you people that don't know her. I mean, she was the prom queen, and then she won the radio station DJ, she's won.
Well, let's face it, she's pretty. You know, she's attractive. She's very intelligent. But I don't think she's talented.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think she lacks social graces.
Do you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
You know, the thing is, she's blonde. And that kind of makes me want to question her intelligence.
Oh.
Well, you know what I have? I have this theory. Now, I can't prove it, but it's a theory. That perhaps when she was little, her mother forced her to be in beauty contests.
Oh,
you know, one of those kids who had to wear a tiara all the time? Mm-hmm.
Katie and Kitty, you're on the air.
Well, I just was going to say that Susie has no problems compared to mine.
Why do you say that?
Well, you're talking to the guy that's been on the Pampers box ever since birth.
Is that right?
I've been, you know, trying to play it down and not tell anyone, so that's why I'm on the radio and not on TV.
Uh-oh, the cuckoo kids. That means it's time to go.
Former town trustee and KDNK DJ Brad Hendricks declared in 1984 on KDNK that he was in favor of having sex with tourists.
Say, I can hear the click and the snap of radios turning on all over town and in places further away than that even. And what we're doing here, of course, is some snoopy reporter picked up that this Friday, as they put it, this is the way it came out in the journal, and it's pretty factual, except the hours are wrong. They say this Friday from 5 to 7, Brad Hendricks will host a discussion on Carbondale's economic future. Put your money where your mouth is, a hard look at our sexual attitude toward tourists. So, and that's pretty much it is what it is, you know, is a hard look toward our sexual attitude toward tourists. And, you know, the whole idea is that we're looking at our economic future, and one of the things that it seems to me the main issue in the main future we have economically for a little growth and expansion is with tourists. And anytime you're talking about relating with people, you got to think about sexual relations. You know, how are we dealing with them? Are we ignoring this whole aspect, or are we as a community going to get together and say, this is the kind of community we want to be? today, for instance, just researching this show, I took a little drive up to Aspen, which has a reputation, a worldwide famous reputation, of having gone through the dialogue and decided just exactly how they're going to deal with their tourists sexually. And I don't know that that's our answer, but it's certainly something that we in Carbondale ought to approach and discuss and look at, from all points of view. You know, personally, it seems to me like we need a hands-on approach, that this is the kind of problem that we need to deal from a practical, hands-on approach. I also think that what the consensus is going to be is that each person is going to have to deal with it on a personal level. We can't have a town policy. You know, I'd hate to have anybody tell me that this is what has to be done with this tourist, you know. But I think that we can come up to a conclusion that, you know, that this town wants to deal with tourists in a certain manner, and everybody would be happy to do that.
It's a small town, but Katie and Kay's 10th birthday is a big success story. From jazz to folk to blues, from early morning ski reports to late night rock and roll marathons, literally hundreds of volunteers have sat in the squeaky chair in the Katie and Kay studios. To represent them all here now would take hours, but collectively, they've kept Katie and Kay on the air, helping it grow and thrive, and making it the indescribable phenomenon that it is. Lee Swidler.
Well, I mean, there were times when I was wondering whether we'd make it to the next year, but when it reached that point, I knew that it was out of my hands. Either the community wanted the station or they didn't.
I just can't believe it. I mean, a lot of people for the kids.
Yeah, but what better thing to come together for than a radio station? Because the radio station is at the pool, and it's at the baseball game, and it's at the mountain fair, and it's at the talent show, wherever else you want it to be. It's the perfect outlet. It really is. And I'm thrilled about it, really. 10 years is a neat thing.
Well put, Lee. Lee Swidler, one of Katie and Kay's founders, and I hear tell Lee will join us at the 3rd Street Center on Sunday, so be sure to say hello to him, and also find me, because that was only 6 audio clips, and believe me, I have at least an hour or more video clips, audio clips from Katie and Kay's archives, so come and find me and listen to some of them with me.